While they're getting started over there, we would like to thank you incredibly much for inviting us to come here today and talk to you, and we sincerely hope that you do not live to regret it. This is the first keynote we've given in a very long time because we get extremely nervous. We don't think that we present particularly well, but we always do our best. And in order to try and safeguard things as much as possible for today, we've put the paper, and we will put the Friday paper as well, everything that we're doing, everything that we've prepared for this conference is on a website and will stay there. So if you want to come back to the stuff after we've finished today, you will find it. It will always be there. It is yours. And the reason that we accepted to come here today and to put ourselves through this anguish is because we've had previously wonderful experiences in Finland, but in particular, the invitation that we received was generous, it was kind, and most of all, it was warm to a point where we wanted to say no, but we couldn't. And thank you. We will be doing our best to talk a little bit today about researching and understanding new literacies from a social languages standpoint. One other thing that I'd add before handing over to Michelle to kick things off for us is that it's always difficult when you don't know an audience. It's always extremely hard to know what to put into a paper when you don't really know who you are speaking to. So for anything that we've got in the paper today that you're already well aware of, we apologise for that, but we've gone about it in the way that we're hoping we'll have something to say to folk here.
And the paper itself is rather long, so the talk may end up butchering it as we get our time wrong and all of that kind of thing, but you can catch up with the things that we sort of skim over as we talk. And we're going to try and leave time at the end for questions in case you want something clarified or you want to raise a point or challenge us on something. So we'll do that as well. But basically, the background to the paper today is it's really grounded in the empirical reality that the internet is truly multilingual. And so we have the multi coming into play for sure, where increasingly the networks we have access to, the social media that we engage in, engage us with a whole range of languages that we may never have had the opportunity to encounter in our face-to-face worlds. And so for us, this is very, very interesting. And certainly for a long time, Danae and Herring have talked about the internet in terms of us as users being members of one or more speech communities who bring to their online encounters shared knowledge, values, and expectations for linguistic communication, where the emphasis really is on meaning-making and sharing ideas rather than getting the language exactly right grammatically. And to this, what we're finding in relation to a lot of the new literacy studies within the language studies field is that people are talking more and more about transnational language flows and how language is crossing national borders on a moment-by-moment basis. And what we're seeing in a lot of social sites and like chat boards and discussions and Facebook is languages being mixed within the same sentence and yet being perfectly understandable to the people with whom they're engaging. And for us, this is really, really interesting and leads us to the whole aim of this paper, where we want to talk about how taking a social languages orientation to looking at what people are doing online and how they're using language and the decisions they're making in their linguistic choices as they go about doing what they're doing and being who they're being, what it can tell us in relation to what does it actually mean to be a proficient language user in current times and in times to come. So that's really the main aim of what we want to do.
Yeah, part of the point being that when you think about transnational language flows in the sense that we mean here, you wonder how on earth it could work, because in schools we're always told to speak properly, to write properly, to do the grammatical stuff, otherwise you will not be understood. But in any number of sites today, we get on there, and the language, from a purist point of view, is terrible, and yet the communication is wonderful, and we've just found social language is a very handy concept for understanding how that happens.
Yeah. And so when we talk about social languages, what we're really talking about is situated language, how it gets used on a moment-by-moment basis to as part of our identities, as part of getting stuff done in the world, and how that shifts and is part of these sort of flows of information and shared resources and collaboration, getting things done in the kinds of spaces that we tend to study online in particular. So what we're going to do is really emphasise that the importance of focusing on language in use. And in this sense, we're not talking so much about how global languages often get reified a lot of times when we're teaching them. We pin them down to a set of linguistic and grammatical systems, and we talk about grammar and vocabulary and correct use and those sorts of things. And but in doing so, we're able to evaluate our students, and we give them a proficiency score. We can even give them credentials based on how good they are at their grammar and how good they are at translating passages and all of those sorts of things. But what we're mostly interested in here is the whole phenomenon of when you start to look at, well, what does it actually mean to be proficient in a world language? When we talk about native language speakers, that native language is no single thing either, that it is actually multiple. But you all know this, but I'll say it anyway. You know, that there are multiple ways of being a native speaker in a particular single language. Oftentimes what happens when people have studied language formally, they may have lovely grammar, they may be able to put together perfect sentences, but what happens in everyday life, they don't often have the colloquialisms or the idioms they're not necessarily able to engage in language on a social basis and things like that. So we're very much interested in the language in use rather than this reified kind of approach to looking at language. And as part of that, what we're going to do is draw very much on James Paul Gee's uptake of Bakhtin's conception of social language and focus very much on three components here. And now these components aren't distinct, they overlap. They're really talking about the same thing. They're really all just talking about social language, certainly the way that we're going to talk about them today. But they sort of highlight or foreground different things that help us to sort of interpret what's going on and to help us to analyse the relationship between language and identity and doing what we do and things like that. So the first one that we want to talk about is the language component of Big D discourse, and Jim G uses discourse in a very particular kind of way. So focusing on, let me just check here, on the first thing about social language as the language component of discourses. What he talks about are how in our everyday lives there are sets and patterns of coordinations of elements that we use, that we draw on, that we take up as part of being a particular kind of person. That those coordinations coordinate us, they coordinate the things that we use and get us recognised as being a particular kind of person doing particular kinds of things. So, for example, we travel a lot. And what we often see is in the waiting lounge at the gate, people who are busily on their phones, they're dressed in a particular way, often wearing a suit or more formal sort of clothing. They seem to be writing emails or text messages. They may be talking quite loudly on their phone about organising things with lots of imperatives. And they often are talking right up to the point where they have to hand over their boarding pass or their actual phone to scan in order to board the plane. And we feel pretty sure that these are people who are engaged in a kind of business discourse, Big D discourse, where the coordinations are about always being available, always working, regardless of what you're doing, knowing that you have to get stuff done before you get on the plane and you lose your connectivity, unless you have wireless connectivity on the plane, that doesn't always extend to spoken language and things like that. And so we see that. And then you see other versions of that. So we do fly a lot between San Francisco and Newark, and oftentimes we see a lot of IT people, and they dress quite differently. They're dressed quite casually, and they all have Apple Macs, and they all have sort of leather satchels and that kind of thing. But we still sort of recognise the way in which they take up this particular role, and they dress in a particular way to distance themselves from this more formal business discourse or coordinations of elements. And as the way that they go about their world.
And, of course, as part of these coordinations, it's not just the suits and the power dressing that's going on, but it is the words that they use, the speech, the content of their messages that they are sending and so on. The language bits, if you like, small stretches of language that make sense within these larger discourses or coordinations that they're engaging in.
Yeah, and Jim G talks about the importance of being in sync with these coordinations, that you have to get it right, that you have to understand that what's going on. If you want to be recognised as being part of these coordinations, you have to do certain things. You can give them a little bit of a spin, but it can't be too much. Otherwise, it won't be recognised as being a valued part of that particular way of being and all of that kind of thing. So in syncness with these coordinations, what he calls the Big D discourses are really important. And so what he also says is that we inhabit and we pass through and we take up and we get recruited to multiple discourses in multiple sorts of ways, even in the same moment and all of that kind of thing. And our identities are very much tied to these discourses, as you can see from the coordinations. And then, you know, our identities are really trajectories, how we move through these discourses and how we take them up at a given situated point in time, or how we don't take them up at that point, but perhaps later on. So it's really quite a complex dance, if you like, through these different sets of coordinations and getting in sync with something. Right. So these Big D discourses are all sorts of kinds. Lots of them are institutional. Schools are a classic case of Big D discourse, where you have to sit in a particular way, you carry particular kinds of props, you have to learn in a particular kind of way and conduct yourself in a particular kind of way, both as the teacher and as the students. Other sorts of discourses are friendship networks, sports groups, fanships, clubs, gangs, and academic disciplines in particular tend to have their own sorts of props and ways of doing things, and in particular the ways of language. So when we talk about academic writing, for example, it's no just one single thing, but it is about writing academically as a biologist, or writing academically as a linguist, or as an English major, and all of those sorts of things. Right.
So at that level, really, it's just about getting the speech right for the coordination that we're in. So if I'm wanting to hang out with my old mate Afro Barry, who rides a Harley Davidson and who usually packing a weapon of some kind or another, because he always likes to be prepared and he often needs to be, if I'm with him in the hotel and we're talking about stuff, it won't do when I want to light up a cigarette for me to say to him, "Oh, excuse me, Mr. Barry, could I prevail upon you, please, for a match in order to light my cigarette?" That's getting it wrong, as far as we're concerned, for this kind of thing. Yeah. The social language doesn't fit, it doesn't run with the discourse, and the question that we're interested in today is, how is it when so many people don't have that degree of linguistic finesse to be able to ask if one might prevail upon another person, how do they get it right when I get it so wrong with my friends, bikers packing in the pub?
So we've talked about identities and how social languages are the language component of discourses. And this is a really central part of social languages, how we communicate who we are and what it is that we're doing. And that leads us to our next, the second part of that three-part analysis of social languages, which is concerned with how people use language to signal who's doing what's and how that gets recognised by other people. So, in lots of ways, This is really to do with, again, bringing together the whole understanding of situated language, what it is, you know, in Colin's example, about recognising what context we're in, who we're engaging with, what our purpose is for being there and being in sync with all of that. And again, what Jim G talks about is how oftentimes who's being what's are a combination of these three things, our social cultural group memberships, our social languages that are part of what it is that we're doing and the context within which we're operating. So, for example, when we're talking about, you know, Colin's an enormous cricket fan and he'll often talk to me about cricket and I really don't know all that much about the game, but I nod and smile and you know, listen like a good wife. And so when he says to me, oh, you know, the Kiwis are playing the Aussies at the Gabba and it's the first day tomorrow, don't know how the Kiwis are going to go, because he is from New Zealand, you see. And I don't know how the Kiwis are going to go, because Baz has been playing in the IPL and he's going to be really tired, and but we'll just have to see what happens. And when you start to unpack that, you start to see that, you know, he's very much a fan of cricket and played you know, high-level cricket as a schoolboy. Still, you know, very, very passionate about cricket. He gets on and reads all the discussion boards about, you know what cricket is? Yeah, good. I just wanted to make sure. And so what you see when you start to unpack this is that the Kiwis and the Aussies, the New Zealanders and the Australians are going to play, and they're like mortal enemies. And so it's always a really good game to watch, because there's a lot of hidden sort of sledging and competition going on and all that kind of thing. The Gabba is a very famous cricket ground in Brisbane, towards the north of Australia, and tends to attract a pretty unruly kind of crowd. And then when he talks about Baz, which is short for Barry, is it Barry?
Brendan.
Brendan McCullum is a very key player on the New Zealand team, and he simply mentions the IPL because he knows that I know about the Indian Professional League, where players from all other countries go over to India and they play in their local. It's sort of like the Indian version of English county cricket, but you get a lot more money for doing it. And then, you know, he's got the social languages of cricket there about that, and assuming that I know who Baz is, that I know about the Gabba, and I know about, you know, the fact that he talks about the first day of the match is starting, and that cricket matches can actually last for 5 days, and so he's talking about a test match. All of that is encoded in the context in which he's speaking, because he's talking to me and he knows I know a bit about cricket, or at least I can fake it pretty well. And that he has the language of cricket when he talks about, you know, Brendan McCullum as Baz, and he talks about, you know, the Gabba and all of that kind of thing. So this is just one example of how even just one or two sentences really carry a lot of information about who he is as a cricket fan, well, fanatic really, and about who he's talking to and how he's presenting himself in terms of his analysis of how the New Zealand team is going to go. So when we talk about social languages, paying attention to who you are presenting as and who you want to be recognised as and what it is that you're doing is really, really important, and oftentimes it's a lot more important than the actual words that you choose in lots of ways. Okay. And part of that, too, is understanding this distinction that Jim G makes between Grammar 1 and Grammar 2, and we find this very useful. So Grammar 1 is just the traditional, conventional linguistic rules and categories for looking at a language. It's tied to a formal system and comprises a traditional set of units like nouns, verbs, inflections, phrases and clauses. And Grammar 2, according to G, looks more at the systems of rules by which we use language in concrete situations and how we take the resources of Grammar 1 and put them together to design, if you like, how it is that we're saying what we say as part of our identity work and as part of reaching our goals and our purposes.
So if we're saying it on a blog, we'll say it one way. If we're saying it to our mothers, we will say it a different way, or say something different altogether, and so on and so on. So it's just basically the idea that we are trying to design what we draw from conventions within the big D discourses to ensure that we get the sync between what we're saying, who we're saying it to, what we're trying to communicate and who we're trying to be. It's language as design, basically.
And so that's their way of looking at social languages. And what we find is that it's a useful perspective when we're looking at what we refer to as new literacy. So we're going to bang on a bit about new literacies now, just to set the scene, and then we're going to talk about three cases and look at how social languages play out through the medium of the different new literacies in which they're engaging. And then we have some conclusions to share with you, if we have time.
Yes, I guess that one of the things that occurred to us at the time when computers were taking off, the internet was taking off, all of these changes that we're well aware of were taking off, people were wanting to talk about this phenomenon in all sorts of different ways. So there were many concepts floating around. There were concepts like multi-literacies, there were concepts like digital literacies, there were concepts like multimodal literacies, and various sorts of theories and stuff that were floating around. For us, we are interested in language and we're interested in literacies as social and historical phenomena. We seized on the concept or the term new literacies because we wanted to try and get a sense of what, if anything, was new about what was going on. That would include things like multi, it would include things like digital. But the important question is how, if we're to live in these times, what do we need to understand about these times in order to do the language stuff well in these times? And we picked up really on two concepts that seem to us to have continuities with the past, for sure, but also to represent certain differences and changes in an evolutionary process that had been going along since the 1950s when the first Turing machines started to get going, but particularly that picked up from the 1980s or so with the advent of fax machines, the speeding up of time and all of that kind of thing.
And personal computers and easier access for everyday people to digital technologies and what that meant then for language and how we engage with each other as humans. And so there's a distinction that we've developed in our own work to help explain more the more recent changes in new literacies as they've taken on a sort of a digital turn and things like that. And this is not to say that all new literacies necessarily entail digital stuff, but we're not going to go there. We're just going to focus on the more paradigmatic cases that are really concerned with using digital technologies and how that changes what we say and how we say it and what we do and how we do it and all those sorts of things. So the two distinctions that we make are between the technical stuff of new literacies and the new ethos stuff. But we're going to talk about the technical stuff first. And this is really where we pay attention to what it means when we are no longer encoding with the printing press and printed language and things like that, but where everything is in lots of ways reduced to pixels and code, and that underpins what it is that we're doing, and that actually gives us a whole range of rich affordances for conveying meaning, for sharing ideas, for participating in groups and interacting with others. And so basically what happens is when we have code and when we have pixels on the screen, we have screens, we have increasingly mobile screens and mobile access to the internet, is that you can basically click for everything. And increasingly it's click, swipe and tap. And what those things do enable you to click and drag. You can you can use digital video editing software that once used to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and be only available to specialists, but now you've got 8-year-olds making their own stop motion animation in quite sophisticated and polished ways. You've got access to all sorts of digital music remixing software that's absolutely free, and now it means that you can be a musician without actually being able to read a note of music. authentic. And so all of these sorts of things through clicking and tapping and swiping and dragging and cutting are very interesting parts of what it means to engage in a new literacy practice. But they're not the only thing. And oftentimes, you know, in some of these earlier conceptions of literacy, it often stopped at the technical level, that it was simply new because we did this new stuff.
Except it was old.
And so what we often saw, particularly in education, and particularly in literacy, which is our home field, is that people were simply digitising old literacies. And so you had worksheets that were put online. You had flashcards that were put online for learning vocabulary. So nothing had changed. There was nothing new about that. They were simply dressed up in digital
costumes. Using PowerPoint to tell a story.
Oh, yeah, PowerPoints to retell stories. All the stuff that's been done in schools for years and years. And so we wanted to be very careful to point out to people that simply saying that the technical stuff makes all the difference isn't quite the whole story. And so that's how we came up with this whole thing about the mindsets that Pepe talked about earlier, and thinking very much about the ethos dimension of using new literacies.
Yeah, simply the sense that if you take something as different as a Wikipedia encyclopedia entry and a Britannica encyclopedia, it's an example we're all familiar with, but it never ceases to amaze me just how deep those differences go, to the extent that with what we call new literacies with the new ethos, there is none of that conventional authorship, or much less of it. No bylines. We'd do anything to have no bylines, because if we didn't have any bylines, we wouldn't have to spend 3 months a year trying to work out our tax on all of the stuff that gets sent in and dribs and drabs in the name of royalties and things for stuff that was 20 years ago that has all of a sudden become valorized as part of the knowledge economy. That's not what we want. We don't want copyright, etc. And a lot of young people and not so young people don't want copyright either. The whole point of putting something on Wikipedia, apart from being passionate about something and wanting to share it more generally and to take part in something with other people, to participate in a collaborative pursuit, the whole point of putting something on Wikipedia is to be able to avoid that kind of authorship and to buy out of that stuff and to buy into a different ethos.
Yeah. And so for us in particular, these three sorts of practices or three sorts of thingies that you can do now with digital technologies are really important dimensions of new literacies. That they are participatory, that now you can have access to free software, you can have access to quite sophisticated ways of creating your own media in ways that weren't possible. You also have access to all sorts of groups of people who are like you that oftentimes you didn't have in your face-to-face life, particularly around fanships. So we have, fan fiction is a lovely example of young people in particular getting together and sharing their passion for, say, anime or for the Hunger Games trilogy or for the Harry Potter series and things like that, where they write stories that extend that particular universe, either within that universe or bringing together universes. So crossover fanfics like Harry Potter and the Hunger Games are very, very popular. But where it's open to everybody. Everybody can join in regardless of how good they are as a storyteller or not. Of course, it's the good storytellers that get more attention and things like that, but still the participation, the opportunity or affordances to just give it a go are writ large in the new ethos of new literacies. Then the collaboration, and this is what Colin was talking about with the Wikipedia example, is where it's all in and nobody owns anything, and authorship is quite a different kind of concept when it's a multiple sort of thing. And you see lots and lots of lovely examples online of how people will give over hours and hours of their time simply to work together with others. And one of my favourite examples of this is the retelling of the original Star Wars movie, where the people organising it cut it up into 10-second segments, and people signed up to retell in their own way a particular 10-second segment. And so you've got the whole movie to the original dialogue, and some of it's in stop-motion Lego, you know, Lego stop-motion animation, some of it's live-action role-play, some of it's cut-paper animation, and all of these different things that move through these multiple media that's a global sort of contribution to recreating this movie from a fan perspective and using whatever was to hand is a really lovely example of people giving themselves over to a passion and collaborating in a way that wasn't about gaining glory for oneself or gaining money or gaining anything else except to say, yeah, I was a part of that.
And also a transcultural and transnational
Absolutely.
Flow of
Absolutely.
Language, of perceptions and so on.
Yeah.
And I guess what happens, because you're all aware of this, and it's been going on for a long time, various new literacies, if you like, became the objects of research attention, and people wrote a lot about what was being done in blogging. People researched a lot about what was being done in video games. People researched all manner of these sorts of new literacies. But to date, one of the things that we don't see going on in this body of literature is people actually focusing on the social languages aspect of this research. It still just looks like traditional literacy research, even if it's yeah. done in the name of multi-literacies, multi-modality, or whatever. It's still not getting at the in-syncness, the coordinations, the way in which this stuff becomes possible on a global scale with very different people participating and negotiating and making sense across what is much more likely to be difference than yeah. it is to be similarity.
Yeah.
And that is why we have this interest, I guess, that we're trying to talk about today, because we think there is a lack or a relative absence so far in the body of research, literature on new literacies, and we think it deserves broadening a little bit to look at from a social languages perspective.
Mm. And that's a nice segue now to talk about our three cases that we want to show you today and talk you through how we see social language playing out in each of these. And at least two of them aren't about becoming super proficient in the target language that they're trying to learn, but nonetheless, they're going to show how they are very, very proficient at being particular kinds of people, doing particular kinds of stuff, and get well recognised for their work. And then the third case is taken from our own teaching, where we've really tried hard to get teachers in master's level courses to engage with social languages themselves around new literacies, and really trying to get them to be inside as to different kinds of literacy practices, like, you know, what's the language that's used when you remix a movie trailer? What language is used in Lego stop motion animation, and why is that? What are the values that are attached to the language, the social language that gets used? How do you come across as someone who may be a newbie but still has some sort of inkling of what's going on and all that kind of thing? So those are the three cases that we're going to talk about now. So the first one is Emilio, and I'll be very upfront here that Colin and I, we're not lazy researchers, but we just like to pinch other people's work. And so this case actually comes from the work of Rama, Black, Van Ess, and Warshauer out of the University of Irvine in California. And what they did was they did a study of six students who were Spanish language learners, and made them play World of Warcraft for 7 weeks. World of Warcraft is a massively multiplayer online game that's a role-play game. Fantasy, it's quest-based and all of that kind of thing. And what they had them do was play predominantly on the Spanish servers, Spanish language servers for World of Warcraft, with the hope that they would improve their Spanish, their written Spanish in particular, because they had them engaging in the chat space. So Emilio himself is a first-year undergraduate at well, I won't tell you the university, but you'll know because I've already said it. And he was a very proficient World of Warcraft player at the start of the project. He'd already, in the first version of World of Warcraft, he'd reached level 60, which is as high as you could go, and he really enjoyed the game and loved it and saw himself as a gamer. And so when they first... But he was, his Spanish level was regarded as... you know, sort of like beginner Spanish, and he would have agreed with that very much so. But he was interested in learning it and things like that. So the first 1.5 weeks, they had them play on an English language server just to get the hang of the game, because not all of the students in the study were familiar with the game. And this is where Emilio really came into his own, where he was able to give a lot of help to people in terms of completing quests and actually navigating the game and even setting up their characters and all that kind of thing, and relying on the more proficient Spanish language speakers at the time to help him when they had to write in Spanish in the chat logs as part of practicing for joining a serious guild where Spanish was the dominant language. So after that 1.5 weeks, they were all put onto the Spanish language server and sent off, and they joined a guild that basically most of the interactions were in Spanish and things like that. And this is part of the... this is the script that we want to talk about in relation to how Emilio, as a beginning Spanish speaker, uses the grammar too to signal that he's a good player of World of Warcraft, even though his language, his Spanish, is not very, is not highly developed.
Back.
Yep. Oops. So I'll just take you quickly through the chat log that we're going to use. And the chat log is text-based, and it runs alongside the game. And guilds use chat very much to organise what they call raids, which is where they have to collaborate and bring together different levels of skills and different kinds of skills in order to defeat a monster or a boss or something within the game. And so it's very fast-paced oftentimes and a very necessary part of the game. But what's happening here is that Emilio is just talking to Draliana as they're playing and finishing up jobs for the guild. You have to sort of do things each day to for the good of the guild and all that sort of thing.
And she's a native Spanish speaker.
She's a native Spanish speaker. She's not in the study. She's part of just a larger world of Warcraft and that kind of thing. So Emilio says, "Hello, Draliana." And Draliana says, "Hello." He says, "What's up? Are you killing Lord Everblaze?" And Draliana says, "Not much. I'm just hoping he gives me what he drops. It glitched because of my lag and it doesn't want to give it to me. I've already killed him 4 times. And Emilio goes, "Lol," laugh out loud. And then he says, "Sorry." And Draliana says, "It's irritating, but you know what they say, the fifth time is the win." It seems not. And so she's playing. She's actually fighting Lord Everblaze at the moment and has no luck. And Emilio writes, "Huh." And then he asks, what's 5TA? And she explains later on that it means the fifth time for Quinta. Draliana says, "The fifth time that I try to kill Lord Everblaze." And Emilio says, "Kill Lord Everblaze?" And Draliana goes, "Yes," and she laughs. And Emilio says, "Seriously?" And then she says, "I'm going to have to try tomorrow." And Emilio, just to be doubly sure, "You're trying to kill Lord Everblaze?" And then she said, "Yes." And then he comes up with quite an extended sentence in Spanish put across a few entries into the chat. "You should abandon the quest and accept again." And Draliana says, "Ouch, you know, the quest really takes a long time." But then he says, "After that, you'll be fine." So what we see going on here are all sorts of very, very interesting things. Here we've got text speak coming into play in relation to the use of the chat. And the only time that text speak seems to be a problem for Emilio is when she writes the 5TA for Quinta, the fifth time. But here you've got Quemelo de Tira, where the K, Q-U-E, for what, is simply just the Q. And that's a very common Spanish language text speak form. Right. Then what we noticed in the the actual transcript is, even though they're on a Spanish server, Draliana most likely has a Spanish language keyboard, that there weren't any accent marks or tilde marks or things included in the language. And we thought that was really interesting. In fact, we thought it was so interesting that we emailed the chief investigator to find out what was going on, and he explained to us that oftentimes in World of Warcraft, because it's so quick in the chat, it's quicker just to sort of Englishify the Spanish in order to get the meaning across without worrying about the correctness of the accent marks or the tilde and all that kind of thing. So what we see here with Draliana is that she's written Maniana there with the IA instead of the tilde mark over the N to signal that it should be pronounced Maniana, and written like that. And so it's perfectly clear to Emilio, and what we see in Emilio's work is that he doesn't use any accent marks and things like that, but she has clearly no trouble understanding what he's saying. We also see a very nice calque, or a loan word that's been translated in what she's saying. And Spanish is a lovely language for doing this, particularly taking up English words and giving them and Spanishifying them. And so the word glitch doesn't translate very easily into Spanish. And so what she's simply done is add the EO noun ending to and made glitcheo. And again, very, very clear to Emilio, because he understands what a glitch means in a game and what lag means in a game. Yeah. In terms of what happens when your server doesn't respond as quickly as it should, and it means that if an item is dropped, it doesn't necessarily appear in your inventory, but it's recorded as having dropped. And so it doesn't matter how many times then you try and fight Lord Everblaze, you are never, ever going to get this fire that you need to free the princess and all that kind of thing. Okay. And then it sort of there's all sorts of complicated things going on in this particular transcript segment. So there's slang, ¿qué pasa? What's up? What's happening? Me choco is, at one point, Draliana says this when she said, it's really irritating me, and me choco doesn't translate very easily into English. So there's some Spanish slang going on. Then there's also quite a bit of English, like lag, when there's that delay in server response. And Draliana herself writes out ha 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 with the H rather than with the J, which is how it's often written in Spanish. There's lol, which is laugh out loud in English, and both of them use that particular text speak form. And then she says ouch, which is again an English expression. Emilio himself uses a lot of these sort of spoken language sounds, like O and Um in his writing. And Rama and colleagues talked about how he often did that to sort of gain time to show that he was still conversing, but he was thinking about the Spanish and trying to get that down. So that was another interesting part of what's going on here as well.
So lots of forms of solidarity and insideliness being demonstrated by these little tricks. But the thing that intrigued me in particular about this stuff is that if I read the Spanish or the English, because I'm not a World of Warcraft player, I don't do it. But I literally could not have made any sense at all of what Emilio and Draliana were talking about, because I didn't know about the glitch and the lag, that it would mean that she could actually have killed Lord Everblaze but hadn't received the fire, which was the point of undertaking the quest. Mm. The text was meaningless to me.
As an outsider and that kind of thing. And there was a lot of assumption there about them being players. So these were the who's doing what. So they're playing this particular game and sharing this particular social language about how to play it, how to talk about the game, both technically as well as in terms of its narrative and that kind of stuff. So clearly, Draliana knows exactly who Lord Everblaze is. As the conversation goes on, it's clear that she understands what it means to actually abandon a quest and restart it. Not all games let you do that. And so she understands that, yes, you can do that in World of Warcraft. It means you have to backtrack quite a bit, but it doesn't mean you have to start right from the start of the game and all of that kind of stuff. So as Colin was saying, there's a lot of knowledge about the game itself encoded into this particular exchange.
And interestingly, one of the other people in the team who was a language learner
Sylvania is a lovely contrast to this because she was evaluated as being a rather advanced Spanish learner. And she participated in the project not because she was a gamer or anything like that, but because she saw it as an opportunity to develop her written Spanish skills. And she was very excited about that. And so she played the game. She was really bad at it. And she tried her best, but she still... And what happened in the chat, instead of this sort of the slang and this ongoing talk about the game and things like that, she wrote in these fully grammatically correct sentences and extended sentences and things like that, and didn't always get a lot of response from other people in the chat channel. And yet, you know, interestingly enough, she was happy with that because she said, "Oh, I am so practicing my English, my Spanish, my written Spanish and things like that." But she never really understood the game, and her chat in the channel very much showed that she wasn't able to actually talk the talk, if you like, of being a competent World of Warcraft player.
And now for 5 minutes on Pearl.
Oh, 5 minutes on Pearl. All right. Okay. So Pearl is a really lovely case that we've poached from the work of Fee Velge and Jan Blommet out of South Africa. And this comes out of a study of 25 middle-aged women who lived in an impoverished and very marginalised community at the edge of Cape Town. So she was really about 30 kilometres from the centre of town. The study was really focusing on women who were single head of the household, matriarchal kind of thing, and they were particularly interested in looking at their mobile phone use, because what they've found is that mobile phone use for people in impoverished communities is actually quite and hasn't had an interesting kind of effect, because text messaging is much cheaper than voice talking on the phone. And what they're finding is that these women who often didn't have a lot of education are now starting to read and write a lot more in English, because English tended to be the interface of the phones that they were using. And so Velge and Blommet were very much interested in documenting how did this play out across the cases of these 25 women. But the case that we want to talk about here is Pearl. And as a preface to that, Pearl was very much committed to becoming very, very proficient at this text speak that we talked a little bit about in the case of Emilio. And text speak itself, it has rules, just like grammar one. The grammar two of it definitely has rules. And it's quite possible to get text speak wrong. And we see, you know, that apocryphal story about LOL, where parents used to think it was lots of love. And so they'd write these stories about, oh, you know, I'm sorry to tell you this, but your grandma's died, LOL, you know. So it's possible to get your text speak wrong, because it is contextual, it is situated, and you need to know a lot about what these abbreviations mean and how to pronounce them and all that kind of thing. But you'll all be familiar with this, so I'm not going to spend any time on it. But the interesting case, a lot of these women, and Pearl in particular, were members of an English language based church that they were very, very passionate about being good members of. And Pearl in particular found that she actually needed to learn to use text speak, because the church itself used a lot of social media. They had a blog, they had a Twitter feed, they had... She was a member of a women's group as part of the church. The church itself is located... This is where it gets complicated. Just bear with me. But the church is located 10 kilometres from her community in a middle-class, mostly Afrikaans-speaking area of what they call coloured and white South Africans. And again, the language of the church was English. And so what she would do in order to participate in these... Because she didn't have enough money, she could afford a phone for her daughter, her 18-year-old daughter, and she would borrow that to send text messages to members of her women's group and members of the church. They also subscribed to what they call prayer chains, where you received a prayer and then you sent it on to other people that you thought would need it. There was also announcements about events that came over text messaging. There were sort of homilies that were sent by pastors and women that were considered as healers within the church that were sent through the text messaging and things like that. And so the Facebook site that the church had also used a lot of text speak and things like that. Pearl herself was an Afrikaans, an isiXhosa, and an English speaker, but she didn't really write and read a lot of English. And so when she decided that she wanted to become more she wanted to participate more in relation to the digital life of her church. She started to make use of a cyber cafe that was right near her church. There was none in her community, so she had to travel 10 kilometres to the cyber cafe. She had to take digital photos of tasks that she did as part of a women's group, insert them into a Word document, send them onto the group as proof that she'd done these good deeds that they'd set each other for each week. But to cut to the chase, this is one of the text messages that she sent to a colleague. And in order to learn text speak, she'd asked her daughter to show her, to explain, to interpret to her what a text message meant. And then what she would do is that she would actually sit down and write out longer words and then start to chop them down until they looked like text speak words, and then she would send them off. So here we've got a classic case of a text message that she sent to somebody who was celebrating their anniversary. She says, "Hi, young bride, happy belated anniversary. Love and cherish and appreciate your husband, James. Sorry, I stutter." And so what we've got here is for anniversary, Velge and Blommet say this was one of the words that she wrote down, and she chopped out letters and things to make it shorter. It's not exactly the conventional way of shortening anniversary. Conventionally, it would be more like A-N-N-I-V-R-S-A-S-R-Y. But it's close enough. It's still understandable. Another word was appreciate, which is a little bit more idiosyncratic, but you can work it out from the context of what it is that she's sending and that kind of thing. What we don't know is what the James, as outsiders, we're not really sure about this joke about stuttering and things like that. We think this is our speculation here, is that in Afrikaans you've got ya-ya means yes, and we wonder if that's a play then on yes, yes, cherish your husband and all of that kind of thing. We're not sure. It sounds good. So we're going to run with it. What she does also have here is some Ishizosa words that, interestingly enough, research, other studies have shown, are never truncated. They're never turned into text speak for text messaging in South Africa. And so she understands that. She hasn't touched those words. That's the ones in bold and all of that kind of thing. So what we see with the case of Pearl is someone very much committed to understanding the social language and mastering the social language of her church, which is very much tied up to text speak, as well as being a good Christian woman and a good member of this particular church by being actively involved in the prayer chains, in updating Facebook, in contributing to Twitter, and completing those tasks that the women's group set for her. Okay. And so in lots of ways, we see a really good example here of how the mobile phone enabled her to participate in these things, and her access to the internet enabled her to participate as a really full and insider member of her church. And that's really the point about Pearl.
With probably adequate small d discourse to intersect with the others.
Absolutely, yeah. Do you want to talk about Brett now?
Yeah, quickly. This is a very different example that builds on work that we do with master students that Michelle referred to earlier. One of the things we've noticed working with teachers in literacy courses is how little, very often, classroom teachers have participated in new literacies as we understand it. They've participated plenty in digital literacies, that is to say emailing and things like that, letter writing using a computer, but much less with anything of the nature of that wonderful introduction that you gave at the start with the booming sound and the stuff captured. That for us, you know, in many ways is a new literacy done on the fly, done collaboratively, done without prior permission of the participants. But they're not au fait with this stuff. Now, the context in which we're teaching them is a research context where they're learning to become researchers. And for that, because it's only a short course and it's done at distance and a lot of it's done online, what we do is we get them to create their own data set as a way of getting around the ethics and all of that kind of stuff at the university. If they're researching themselves and it's for teaching purposes, they are able to do this stuff without having to go through the long consent process, which would make a semester-long course on data collection absolutely impossible. You just couldn't get it done in advance. So because they're needing learn to analyze data, and in order to do that, they need to learn how to collect data for analysis. And because they don't know anything very much about new literacies of the types that their students their own children are engaged in, we set them a task that they have to teach themselves using all of the online information available, and we won't tell them. They have to teach themselves how to create a piece of media that will be a first shot, but that should be taken seriously by other people interested in that kind of thing. If it's a movie trailer or whatever, it should be good enough to win their respect, at least as a first effort. So they're expected to try and get, to some extent, on the inside of this form of media that they are creating. They're to teach themselves how to do it, and all the way through they are to document, making field notes, capturing speech, etc., the processes that they're going through, that, so that they can analyse this data subsequently. Now, on this particular day, Brett is not in the course. He's a person at distance who was hired by the university to drum up cohorts and recruits for the course. He takes care of the bookings at the hotel conference area where the course takes place and the face-to-face sessions, all of this kind of stuff. He's also a teacher, and he also knows everybody that takes the courses. In this particular context, there were four women, mature age students, not at all tech savvy, absolutely not tech savvy, but not tech phobic either. They're prepared to have a go at it. They're going to have a go at it, but it's going to be something that's within their means. And if we just work through the Brett slides a little bit, what they've decided that you just keep rolling through them while I talk. What they decided to do was something that drew on who they were as people. One of the women was an artist, and she could do artwork. Another woman was a singer, and they thought they'd use music. She might sing, and somebody else was a poet. They weren't sure what they were going to do, but what they were going to try to do was to take video of the painting and sort of speed it up and get it so that it told the story of the thing being painted much more rapidly than it was being painted, and you'd have the equivalent amount of sound or audio going on against the background, so it'd end up something like a music video. And they weren't particularly sure how to do it. They didn't know whether to use conventional computers, because when we teach this course, what we want folk to do is to learn some of the digital stuff as well. The last thing we want them doing is using a confounded iPad app to just, you get what I mean? We want them to learn some tech stuff. We want them to become a bit like geeks. We want them to geek out a little bit on what they're doing, to get lost, to get confused, to understand something about the technologies. In this particular case, Brett, who was the outsider, had decided not to go home to his wife and family on that Saturday morning. He was going to hang out with this group and sort of shepherd them along to get them on the way to doing something that was manageable. Now, in asking who is doing what here, who's Brett being, and what is Brett doing, as part of the social language thing, looking at the collective text that Michelle scrolled through, he came up with five things that we thought he was doing and being in this situation. Five things that could be particularly pertinent to educators, because we see them all as being part of what it is to be an educator. In this one, we see him, to some extent, acting as a consultant. He's trying to find out what the students have in their heads about what they're going to do. A lot of room, you're going to need a lot of disk space for doing this. It's a lot of data. You videotape and then you speed up. He's trying to find out. He's trying to get inside their heads to find out what it is they're going to do. They thought they were doing time lapse. Even Brett thought that they were talking about time lapse. It turned out that they were just going to do a fast forward thing. They were just going to videotape 15 minutes or so of painting using a sponge and making an abstract design, and then speed it up and slow it down to suit the length of the thing that they were the artifact they were going to use for the audio. In this one, so that was a consultant. Here we see him as an ally, because Brett knew perfectly well that I didn't want them just using iPads or anything like that. But he cuts right, he doesn't leave my option open. He's not going to let these people be let down, and so he comes in as an ally for them. He's an ally on their side, speaking for them. Don't think you're going to get your way with this, Colin. He's a confidence booster. He has to try, or in speaking the way he's speaking, he's trying to give them confidence that they can do this job, that it's within their capability, it's within the capability of an iPad. They're going to be able to sort through that. I'm trying to speed up to get to the end of this because we're not going to make it.
And part of that was about signalling his own expertise, that they would have confidence in him as a confidence booster. So in this one, he talks about that he knows how schools work, that if you go into and talk to your school administrator, they're highly likely to give you an iPad. You can wipe it clean, free up the hard drive, and be able to videotape your painting in one session, because that's what he wanted to make sure, that they didn't have to chop and change and start and stop and things like that. And he was just really trying to streamline it for him by showing his expertise, giving them advice that way. Right.
He also conveys extreme collegiality in the whole thing. All of his language, he doesn't talk down to them. He doesn't use language that's grandiose. He's in solidarity with them. He is speaking to them respectfully in ways that they will understand, and at the same time know that they can manage. In another sense of collegiality, somebody in the group has twigged to the fact that I would prefer they did it on a real computer and learn some real computing capacities rather than just having it all automaticized. And he basically comes in and says, I think, you know, that would not be the way to go. And in the ultimate act of solidarity, he talks them out of doing what they might otherwise do.
Yeah, but very much signalling himself, or presenting himself, his identity as being an excellent educator, one who can support people, he can be an ally, he can listen to what it is that they can do and what they don't understand, and help them to find a way through the particular task. So in conclusion, we do have a conclusion, but we're only going to talk about one of them. What we were going to talk about was the social language proficiency and the conundrum it has for us as teachers, particularly, well, actually for you all, as language teachers, in that it's actually very difficult to teach a social language. And we've learned that time and time again through this particular course, that it really does have to do with people's passions and their interests and what it is that they're committed to. So that's the rub when we talk about the importance of social language, that it's really, really difficult to actually get it right in classrooms. But you can read more about that in the paper. The second one we had, we just wanted to emphasise the real importance of people who are studying social languages or studying language literacy and new technologies or new literacies, to really be inside as to the practice. You really, as Colin was saying about the World of Warcraft thing, Rama and Black out of the Melio study were avid World of Warcraft players themselves as researchers, and so they could really interpret and understand what was going on in a way that perhaps someone like Colin, who prefers solitaire to World of Warcraft, wouldn't necessarily have the nous or be able to give the nuances. So for us, when we're talking about social languages, when we're talking about new literacies, it really is about you have to be an insider, and it can't just be a fly-by-night kind of thing. You have to spend time and commit to that space or that interest or that passion. The other thing is that it really does need ethnographic research, that just grabbing the language bits alone aren't enough. You need to have a look at what is the context, what is the thing that's going on, who is doing what, and how are they signalling that through their language choices, their use of props, how they're drawing on resources, the kinds of ways in which they're interacting and positioning others and all that sort of thing.
Because you would have got some of the stuff about Brett just from the transcript. There is stuff about Brett, for example, that can be got from the transcript. But so much of what we analysed in this G kind of fashion about who's doing what in the case of Brett came from having been in the situation, having been part of the conversation, but also particularly having known Brett for the best part of 10 years. So all of that stuff comes in to doing this kind of research.
Yeah, yeah.
The final thing, really, I suppose, that we'll just signal it here because there's absolutely no time to go into it, and it goes to stuff that Mike was talking about in his introduction about futures of language learning and technology and all of that kind of thing. One of the things that has intrigued us is John Seely Brown and John Hagel and Davison's account of the difference between push and pull, of a paradigm shift that's going on at present in the world in terms of how to resource the resources that we need for getting things done. And he said that in the old days, you know, back at the start of the 20th century and before, everything was about programs. Governments had lots of money. They got all these resources. It was a matter of just in case. Everything was in there, and it was pushed at people in the way that programs are delivered. It's pushed. Now they are saying with the new technologies, with the communications means that we have available, etc., there's a shift moving, not totally, but significantly towards pull, that you pull on the stuff that you need when you need it, as you need it. And presumably one of the things that Rama and co. were doing in their research when they got Emilio and others to participate in that program was basically saying, here's a platform, here's World of Warcraft, here's something that you can pull on to try and enhance your language learning. And what we've noticed in our own lives, and we'll leave it with this, if you're interested in it at all, you can go back to the paper, but Michelle and I have learned Spanish in very different ways. I learned Spanish at university in a program. I learned Spanish in a program. Michelle learned Spanish and some very colourful Spanish, learning to cook with a neighbour, an elderly neighbour in our street, a woman who gave Michelle no grammar. Everything from Michelle in Spanish is in the present tense, but her vocabulary is magnificent. She does reasonably okay. In fact, she does very well in conversation, but she didn't apply for jobs in Mexico because she didn't think her Spanish was good enough to be able to teach. I have no vocabulary. I can spell out an academic concept like data collection with 23 words in various combinations. It takes 3/4 of an hour, but I get there. And being insensitive, I have no problems doing keynotes in Spanish and boring people, sending them to sleep as I do in English. But the thing is that between the two of us, we do okay. If we co-teach with Michelle's conversational Spanish and my correct Spanish, albeit limited in terms of vocabulary, we do so much better because between us, we meet the social language requirements of getting the job done. And You just have to take it on faith that we can do it in Spanish, because we sure as hell haven't done it in English today, but we've done our best. Thank you very much.
Quitos, quitos. Thank you. Sorry.